Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Never Strays Far, a cycling podcast with me, your host Ned Bolting, and
me, David Miller. Oh, ex-former professional cyclist. There you go, Ned.
There you go. That was good. That was a good way. That was a good way of starting. But now let's have this bit here. Never Strays Far is proud to be supported by BICMO Cycle Insurance, protecting the world's riders and the places we ride. Head to BICMO.com and use the code NSF24 on their quote page to get 12 months of award-winning BICMO insurance for the price of 11. Terms apply. Yes, our thanks to BICMO, who you'll be hearing plenty of in the next podcast that we're planning on recording in the immediate aftermath of Liège-Bastogne-Liège with Peter Kenyuk, hopefully. But this, David, is a kind of we just slipped this extra. Well, slipping this extra one in as a little bonus, aren't we?
Because we have
to end up
we're together
in the same city.
We're in real life, IRL. And we're here
in London
to do something this evening, and you said, well, why don't we sneak in a mini pod? And you said, let's go and do something different and stray far.
Yeah, although you say different, there is a marked similarity between where we find ourselves at the beginning of this pod in some ways and where we found ourselves at the beginning of the Flanders pod, if you can think back to that. Can you remember our first bit that we recorded?
We were inside a church.
And then outside a church.
Oh, bloody, where you are now. Just
and here we are, right outside a church.
Which one's this?
St. Martin's. You owe me 3 farthings. Say the bells of St. Martin's. Okay. When will you pay me? Say the bells of Old Bailey. When I grow rich, say the bells of Shoreditch. When will that be? Said the great bell of Lee.
Well, Ned, is that a London... Well known. If you're a Londoner, you have to know that.
Well, it's quite well known, isn't it? Here comes a candle to light you to bed, and here comes a chopper to chop off your head. Oranges and lemons, so the bells of St. Clement's. That's how it starts.
Now I know.
And it's have you ever read 1984 by George Orwell?
I think I started it when I was young and then didn't finish it.
Because you remember the main character, Winston Smith, who becomes kind of like disillusioned with the state, and then he gets his head turned by the revolutionary, you know, underground. Mm-hmm. The bells of St. Martin's.
Wow.
Anyway, the state, the 1984 state, has erased the past and rewritten history from year zero as revolutionary, well, as Stalin did and all that sort of thing. But he has a childhood memory of what things were like before the revolution, so he can remember the war. As in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And he remembers, he's got a childhood memory of his mother singing to him and putting him to sleep by singing Oranges and Lemons, Say the Bells of St. Clement's. And it kind of haunts him because he connects it with this kind of past that predates the state.
And everything.
So it becomes almost a symbol for life outside of the kind of holistically sealed walled garden that the state kind of erects that constrains his life.
Theme through it all.
Yeah. Huh. There but this is an amazing church. You go in there. It's an amazing church because, for those of you who don't know London as well, it looks onto the National Gallery and Trafalgar Square, and it's had a long, long, long history associated with looking after the homeless, providing for people who are rough sleepers and homeless. Huh. So, on any given day, you'll find there are a lot of people just seeking a bit of shelter in that church.
Oh wow!
And often they'll be asleep in the pews.
Huh.
You know, just very much allowed and tolerated and wanted and invited to share the warmth of the church and kind of like take a bit of comfort from that. So it's a pretty special place, actually.
Yeah.
There's been a bucket load of cycling.
There has.
Actually, because we're in the capital city of the United Kingdom, Great Britain and Northern Ireland, London, I think we can afford ourselves a slightly British perspective on the last couple of weeks of racing. Because
in particular, the last 48 hours.
Last 48 hours.
What happened before then? Recap.
Well, we've moved on. So we did Flanders, you and me.
Yeah.
Then the following weekend, I was back into Flanders and we did Paris-Roubaix. I don't know if you managed to listen to that pod.
I did.
Yeah, it was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
Amazing experience.
Oh, it sounded insane.
And then, of course, with Paris-Roubaix, the cobbled classics, the Flandrian classics, that chapter gets closed in the cycling calendar and we all move on. And normally you and I sort of like whine and not whine, that's the wrong word, but we're fairly sanguine about our lack of appreciation for the Ardennes classic.
Yes, we are a little bit. And Amstel was a little bit.
Nah.
It was, I don't know, that's not right to say. You know what it is? It was the rainbow shadow of Mathieu van der Poel all over it, because everybody was waiting for him to do something. So even though there was a great race going on, Mathieu van der Poel was kind of, what's he going to do? Oh, he's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
And so it was actually a normal great bike race, but it didn't have.
Yes.
And actually a very exciting one. The first one we've had a genuinely exciting final, because a lot of them being solo.
It was really good, to be fair. It was really good. I mean, you had to get over that weird thing. And I remember thinking of you when I was watching Amstel Gold. I didn't watch much of it, but I watched bits. But I thought, the roads are too good.
Mm.
It's that thing, Netherlands roads are just not Belgian roads.
No. They're very narrow, though.
They're very narrow, and it does make for a good race.
It does make for a good race.
It does make for a good race.
And Pidders did ride fantastically. And you called it beforehand. You said it's a big, big day for Pidders.
Big year for him.
Big year for Pidders.
But he's, I mean, that's a brilliant way of getting his
that was a magnificent
road racing season.
Win.
Especially given that, he's just come back from that crash and the
reconnaissance
of the time trial at the Basque Country.
I always say that about crashes. Sometimes, actually, I've seen his dad, Giles, when he was in Girona with the junior team who were preparing for Roubaix during their Easter holidays. And I was there when Tom crashed in the time trial recon before Pays Basque. And I was saying to him, sometimes these crashes are blessing in disguises, because you come out of it and you think everything's ruined, because your cookie cutter template that you've been relying upon is kind of, well, if I'm not doing that, then how am I going to do what I'm supposed to do off the back of that?
Yeah.
But actually sometimes that reset, it just, as long as you go in and think, okay, well, things are different now. I just got to carry on with the difference and see what happens. And I think it's arguable that Pidders wouldn't have won Amstel if he'd done Pays Basque and finished it.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's kind of sliding doors, isn't it?
Yeah.
That sort of, if you can have that ability to kind of rise above and kind of just get back up and go, well, there's nothing I can do about that now, let's move on. But because often you're set in that, I need to do Pays Basque to have the form for the Ardennes.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not.
I also think you spoke to Giles Pidcock. Yeah. I had a quick word with him at the finish line in Roubaix as well, because it's quite strange that day at Roubaix, because they have the junior race.
They heaved on the juniors.
The under 23 race.
Yeah.
And the elite men. All three, the Pidcocks had representation in all three of the races.
Giles had his junior team in the race.
DS. Joey Pidcock was on Pete's team in the under 23. Had a really good race as well. And Pete and Tom did the...
That's wild.
Did the elite. Anyway, Joe Pidcock was telling me that Tom Tom obviously had this crash, and then I think it was obviously, I mean, there's no footage of it because it was in reconnaissance, but it was obviously a really big down.
Tending to be off TT bikes as well.
TT and all that. So he obviously went down really hard and then kind of instinctively did the right thing and went, well, I'm not starting this race.
Yeah.
But within a couple of days, like, he had an x-ray, nothing actually broken. Yeah. And then within a couple of days he went, I'll just test this out.
Yeah.
I'll go through 1 hour ride, see how it feels. Yeah. Ended up doing 6.5 hours in the saddle.
Right, okay,
came back, went absolutely fine.
Yeah,
within days of crashing. So when he would have been tearing himself in and out,
quickly
racing Basque instead. Mm. So super fresh and a very smart race from him, wasn't it, throughout?
It's brilliant.
He did so little in that group once the group got away.
Mm.
But every time he needed to be the rider who forced the next selection.
Yeah.
So it went from whatever, 13 riders down to 7, down to 3. It was just
quite
did
clinical,
enough, didn't
wasn't
he?
It? Yeah.
He just went, right, okay,
just
now.
Just forcing it.
And then back off again.
Yeah.
I thought it was a very smart bit of racing. And
it
then
was really good
backed
racing.
Himself in the sprint.
Yeah. Chapeau Pidders.
Chapeau Pidders. And the women's race was just as good, actually, and interesting before that. And ended with...
Voss.
Well, Voss, but Lorena is really... Yes, Voss, but it was actually the story
Wins
of Lorena
win.
Phoebus, wasn't it?
God, that's, in the race like that, that's horrible.
Yeah.
Posting it.
It's a big race, that.
So it's Cyril Guimard.
Both Dutch riders, of course, yeah. And it's the Dutch classic.
Cyril Guimard used to always say, do not raise your arms until you cross the line.
Until after you've crossed the line,
until
ideally.
After you cross the line. That's what I mean, until you cross the line.
Yeah, until you...
Because it's like you're putting on, it's like air brakes, like Top Gun air brakes. You sit up and it's like all of a sudden, you slow down massively. Yeah.
It's weird how often it happens though, isn't it?
It is weird, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I'm pleased for Voss. She's had a great year so far.
She's won Omloop Het Nieuwsblad.
Yeah.
And Amstel Gold.
That's...
And something else as well, I don't know. Yeah. She's like, I mean, evergreen. Just
she's
and
brilliant.
Yeah, and that was something of a... Well, I don't know if you can call it a surprise, Marianne Vos winning a bike race.
Yeah, no.
Can't really call it a surprise. And then we went to Flesh Wallon, which both the men's and the women's race were on the same day.
Yes, women's after men's.
Women's after.
Got better weather.
They had slightly better weather. In fact, much better weather. It was horrific.
It was. I was watching it on and off. It was horrible.
Yeah.
So Kwiatkowski, the Ineos pole, just saying just how he just shut down completely when the weather came in. Just kind of his body. Just, I think he said if you have like two shots of vodka or something, the shock that puts your body under, that's how he felt. He compared it to like that. Okay, interesting. Polish way of looking at it.
Yeah.
But I mean, but it was watching Stevie Williams was just imperial.
Yeah.
Because I went back, I knew he'd won and I hadn't actually watched the finish because I had to go and do kid stuff. Came back and watching him going up Muir, there's no way you said he was in the race until he went. Because he was in a bigger gear and he was just like back about 10, 12 riders.
Yeah.
Looked like it was just like no go. But when he went, it was just shocking how much better he was. It was so good.
And it's been coming, that big race win. I mean, he's had some big race wins in the last couple of years, but that's the biggest. That I mean, he said as much.
Yeah.
Every time I watch that finish on the Muir de Huy, and I've watched it so many times, I'm surprised by how long it goes on.
Oh, it's awful.
It's just...
But even when he went with like 250 metres to go and it just went on forever.
It's horrific, isn't it?
Yeah. What did they do? They did it more this year, didn't they? Two more times or one more time?
I don't know, actually.
They did. They kind of
Yeah, they definitely did it multiple times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still the same
race. Because normally it's like... everyone just waits for the finish.
Literally. It's like sprint finish for climbers.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
And Kasia... Niewdowski.
Kasia Niewdolma, David.
Niewdolma, sorry. Yeah, Niewdolma. She, that's her first win in 5 years.
Yeah, since the Women's Tour of Britain.
It's wild.
5 years ago. And she's been second so many times. And when she's not second, she's fourth or third or fifth. You know, she belongs to that. It's weird, isn't it, women's racing over the last 5-6 years. They've just been, especially when Van Vleuten was still racing.
Yeah.
And Voss was still at her very best, even though she's close to that now. But there've been this kind of like clutch of riders, including Cecilia Uttrup-Ludwig, who just, and Ashley Moorman-Passio, who kind of exist in the same bracket.
Yeah.
And they share the wins out between them, except for Kasia.
Yeah.
It's been so strange.
It's true, actually.
She's
wins
been
more than
in
her.
That mix of kind of half a dozen elite riders who are always, doesn't matter whether it's a flat race or a hilly race or a mountainous race, she's kind of in the mix.
Yeah.
And yet it's just eluded her to this point. So a very popular win.
Back in the game.
Very popular win. And I happened a couple of days before she won.
Mind you, she did win the Gravel World Championships.
I mean.
Not road.
It's not road, is it?
No, it's not road.
It'll become road.
Yeah, it will become road.
And
it
devolves into something different. a couple of days before that race, I noticed that young, well, probably not so young anymore, Taylor Finney posted, who you know quite well, don't you?
Quite well, yeah.
Yeah. He posted a video from his atelier.
Oh, yeah, his
in Girona.
Art studio, his atelier.
Did he live in Girona or just outside?
Yeah, Girona. Yeah. They've got a little atelier.
It's pretty wild.
On the edge. He's had that for years now.
It's pretty amazing. He had like, it was like, he had the, like it's a big garage sort of situation and he had like.
It's exactly, yeah, like a mini warehouse.
Yeah, a mini warehouse kind of thing. Mm. And he doesn't appear in the video, so it's all his POV. So he's just moving the camera around, showing us what's going on. And there's like jazz playing.
Oh, yeah.
Really loud.
Yeah.
Kind of Charlie Parker vibes, bebop.
Yeah.
But with a bit of a twist. and you just get a little sneaky glimpse at all these massive canvases that he's been working on.
That's brilliant. He loves it.
Very abstract.
Yeah.
Quite messy, quite kind of like earthy, quite a lot going on, a lot of paint.
Yeah. Basquiat vibes. Yeah.
He's pretty serious about it, isn't he?
That's it. He's an artist now. Yeah. Hats off to him. Got out of the racing scene, went into the art scene.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he does love it. It's very cool.
That's pretty cool.
Hip. He is the definitive archetypal poster boy hipster.
Yeah.
He's amazing. Legit.
Yeah.
Yeah, all over it.
Yeah.
And then today, Simon Carr.
Yeah, well, before we leave that, the Flesh While On Alone, I got a message this morning.
Oh, yes.
From the winner of the men's Flesh While On, biggest win of his career. And Stevie Williams, let's face it, had, I think for 2 or 3 years, worked his way through a knee injury that almost stopped his professional career, you know, almost just halted it in its tracks. And he's come bouncing back since he's got on top of that, taking the general classification of the Arctic race in Norway last year.
Mm-hmm.
Did he win a stage of the Tour de Suisse, or have I dreamt that?
I don't know, I can't remember.
You're not sure. And then this year, straight away, scoring the GC win and a stage at the Tour Down Under, the Queen stage of that. And then going close.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda, Tour of Britain.
Coulda, shoulda. Why didn't he win that? I can't remember. Just went a bit hard, blew up a bit, didn't he? The Kefili Mountain.
Shouldn't have gone with Carlos Rodriguez.
Yeah.
Exactly. When he knew he shouldn't.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
That opportunity may not come back.
No.
So, but anyways, he won the, what else did he win? Have I said, he came close to winning a stage on a couple of occasions of Catalonia this year. A couple of top tens there.
Yeah, he got second on the first.
Yeah, something like that. And then comes here and does that on the Mule de Puy. Anyway, he sent me this message a couple of hours ago.
Hi, Ned. Really, really happy to win the race yesterday in Flesh While On. It's always been a dream of mine to win one of the classics in the Ardennes. So to do that yesterday in such tough conditions is special. So it was a tough day and a war of attrition, but really happy to come out on top. And obviously those winters in Wales as a youngster have paid dividends. So a great block for us as a team, and now we can go into Sunday's race with a lot of confidence and try and get a result there as well.
So hats off to Stevie Williams, and what were you going to say?
Simon Carr,
Tour of the Alps.
Tour of the Alps. I didn't see how it happened. Only watched
Giro del Trentino. It used to be called, didn't it?
Yeah. I don't actually know who won the GC.
It's not finished yet.
Oh, it's one more day. It's five days.
It's a 5 day. I had to check. Don't worry. I had to check.
Okay. So who is in the lead?
Well, Juan Pedro López.
López.
The tiny, tiny.
What happened to Foss?
Keyring rider.
Did he get slammed today?
Foss just had one day in the jersey, I think.
But then he held on yesterday. He was in the second.
Two days in the jersey. He lost it yesterday.
Because
in the pouring rain as well in northern Italy, Juanpe López won his first ever professional race.
Wow.
And put minutes into everyone and took the jersey by a chunk of time. But today, when Simon Carr took the stage, López had to ride hard on the front of a group of favourites just to hold on to the jersey.
Yeah.
And he did. And at the end, they all came around him and sort of took a little bit of time on him. So with one stage remaining, your man, Ben O'Connor, sits in second place at just over 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And there's two big climbs and then a descent tomorrow.
That's a horrible race, isn't it? Such a mountains every day.
It's Tour of the Alps, David.
Yeah, true. Good name. Yeah.
Did you not race that?
No.
Back in the Giro del Trentino days?
If I did do it, it would be Romandy, not Alps.
Different time of year as well.
A week apart.
I mean, the race has always been there, hasn't it? Just in a different name.
Yeah,
and it's always
Giro
been a
Trentino. Yeah.
It's been to the Giro what the which race is it? Is to the Vuelta? I won't say Basque Country, but that's not what I mean.
Murcia.
I've just gone blank. This is happening to me more and more often.
There's not many stage races in August in Spain.
But there is one. There's a week-long stage race that is very hilly.
Burgos.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. And
that's also in the Basque Country, isn't it?
It's just south of the Basque Country.
Oh, is it? Yeah. So it is. It does for the Giro what Burgos does for the Vuelta. It's just fine tuning and
Got you.
It was also that race. Tour of the Alps was a kind of coming of age of Theo Gegenhardt.
Yeah, and he smashed it last year, didn't he?
Last year was it?
Yeah.
Yep. And then
was
absolutely brilliant at the Giro until he crashed down.
Yeah.
I mean, potentially race winning brilliant.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, he was amazing.
So, Bike so racing. Simon Carr won the stage.
They did, but Is he's not on GC, I guess?
No, I don't think so.
But
no.
It looked like he was in GC. Was he in a break? I don't know. Whatever happens to win a stage
like that. No, I don't
think
so. I looked at the top 10. I don't think he's in top 10. So he's off GC.
But still, it's mountain stage. And when you're mountain stage with a GC race coming up hot, coming in hot, it's very impressive. So, good old Simon Carr.
Yeah. So British success.
It's a lot of British success, actually.
That's pretty mad, isn't it?
Across all different teams.
Mark Cavendish is starting his, rebooting his season, isn't he? After a long bout of illness. And when he had that win really early on in Colombia, but then no results of any description.
Gone back to basics, went to the Isle of Man and stuff, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rocked up at a local race, didn't he?
Yeah. Got 27th or something.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
But he's going to the Tour of Turkey.
Yeah.
Which is normally a bit of a sprint fest with a climb. Chuckson.
Sprinting's not an addiction. I saw the headline.
Yeah. Kind of is for him though, isn't it?
That's what I thought.
I thought it was a bit contradictory. Of all the riders to say that.
Who just loves it.
Yeah.
Literally addicted to it. Loves winning. Basically, if it's not an addiction, it's a compulsion. It's a fine line between the two. But, well, it'll be a big test for him.
Yeah.
See if he's back in the right.
Talking about riders, personalities. Well, he's an ex-rider with whom Mark Cavendish used to have a very productive relationship, as did you. I exchanged messages yesterday with Rod Ellingworth.
Oh, Tour of Britain. They pulled together the women's tour. That's
they
remarkable.
Have pulled together 4 days of a women's tour. It's now, this is a complicated thing. It's now going to be called
Tour of Britain Women.
Is it?
Yeah.
Not Women's Tour of Britain.
Tour of Britain Women.
And Tour of Britain Men, presumably.
Like Tour de France Femme. Tour of Britain Women.
It's quite strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, syntactically, quite strange.
Yeah, it is. Women's Tour of Britain. Maybe that just sounded a bit derogatory. Tour of Britain.
Well, not if you call it.
Britain.
I mean, what you do have to do is rebrand them both, which I assume that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that whatever they're.
Tour of Britain Men.
Yeah, I guess it's going to be called the Tour of Britain Men. Damn well should be.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a.
Damn well should be.
Well, I think there's a. I think there's a very strong argument.
No, I think you're right.
That the Tour de France. Should be called the Tour de France Homme.
Yeah.
And I actually don't really see the justification for not doing that. Mm. Just like the FIFA World Cup should be the FIFA Men's World Cup.
Oh, there you go.
Because, you know, if you consider the Olympics, you don't have the 100 metres final.
100
and the 100 metres final for women.
That's very true. That's
do you?
A very good comparison. Yeah.
You just don't have that.
No.
So I think that these slightly more traditional sports need to... And I think you're right. And I think British Cycling with their rebrand. But the other kind of interesting thing about that, David, is that one of the reasons why, and I think I'm right about this. I stand corrected if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. One of the reasons why the Women's Tour, as was when it was organised by Sweet Spot, was called the Women's Tour, and didn't have the word Britain in it, was because had Sweet Spot included the word Britain in it, they would have had to pay a license. To British Cycling.
Got you.
As they did with the Men's Tour of Britain.
Yeah.
Which is nuts.
It is nuts. I still find that nuts.
It's very cycling, isn't it?
So cycling.
Yeah.
So cycling. So Rod's all good for Tour of Britain then?
What yeah. I mean, I sent him a congratulatory message. Or just said, like, you know, because I gather, you know, he came at... He's done some sort of like interviews and bits and pieces of, you know, above the parapet saying, we've got these plans and it's going to happen. And this is where they're announcing the route for the women's race, which I think is largely in the northwest for 4 days. And
Wales.
Yeah,
and
North Wales and the northwest. I think Manchester's holding a...
Yeah, it's like I think it's two stages, which are the same start-finish towns.
But that's...
Wrexham. That makes total sense.
It makes sense. We had a bit of that on the Men's Tour of Britain last year. And in economically straightened times, that's what's going to happen.
Better,
you know.
Better for everyone.
So, and it's a circuit, and fine. Bring it through the start-finish line a couple of times. That'd be great. But anyway, he messaged me back saying, downplaying his actual contribution. He was saying that he's been brought in quite late and in a kind of consultancy role. I think his role will grow as the races get closer. Mm-hmm. And actually kind of nuts and bolts of getting the race on the day will become more of his thing. But in terms of, you know, the finances of it and getting the local authority, I think that's been done behind the scenes by the CEO and people at British Cycling. So burying the hatchet and whatever your position vis-a-vis their relationship with Sweet Spot, I think you've got to take your hat off to them or show them, you know, at least acknowledge the fact that it looked pretty bad for these races 6 months ago, and it appears that we're going to have them, albeit in, perhaps in slightly shortened form. I think the men's race might be
7 days, not eight.
6 or 7 days instead of eight.
Yeah, maybe six, yeah.
Yeah, so that's...
Oh, well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Something's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rod Ellingworth. You worked with Rod, didn't you, look?
I did, Rod. A legend. I remember him back in the days when he was GB and looking after the under-23s and living with the riders. And, yeah, he was all part of... He was the everyone always talked about Dave Brailsford and Shane Sutton, but Rod was definitely the kind of the third in that sort of bringing it up. Then my sister came in for the actual World Tour team. But before that, it had been Rod who had basically running the road scene for British cycling. The golden boys, the golden era. They were all Rod's boys. Yeah.
It's pretty tough, wasn't he?
He was very tough.
Tough with riders, like properly kind of like... And it's like to those of us who don't only see the public Rod, it's kind of hard to square that because he's very affable. He's kind of like on-screen personality, isn't it? But very different behind
the scenes. He's very much a growth mindset kind of...
What does that mean?
That means there's very little congratulations. It's very much about kind of...
Stick.
Always progression. Always kind of... If you're doing it well, then you're doing it. And if you're not, well, that's fine. We'll fix it. We've got to figure out how you get back doing it well again. But there was very little, you're doing well, well done, congratulations. It was just always, we're moving forward, moving forward, moving forward. So, yeah, and I think that was one of the reasons for a lot of those guys' success, because they were always in that state of that growth mindset. Kind of, they'd never arrived. They'd never got kind of, oh, we're here now, well done. No, we're going up to the next level, going up to the next level, going up to the next level. So you never really felt like you were... that Rod was pleased with how you'd done. I don't think for many of them, because he always thought you could get more out of yourself. And I think it's that was the
but
kind of recipe.
For you, because you never worked with him at Sky, obviously, so you dipped in and out for the Worlds, and not the Olympics.
Yeah.
So that was when you... Well, no, actually, you were
London, part of
it. And the London Olympics, of course you did. But because you had that kind of slightly fleeting working relationship, even though you probably knew him much better than that, was it not like, oh, I don't really have to listen to this, I'm...
No, I loved it. I actually was, I found it really inspiring. And
right.
Because I thought it wasn't an attitude that I was accustomed to. It seemed a lot more professional than professional cycling, even the under 23 team, just the way they operated and that sort of, that work ethic they had, that growth mindset, that belief that anything was possible was very much kind of, it was inspiring. And they did things they thought differently because they had none of the burdens of the history of the sport and traditions. They were just coming in.
Yeah.
So, you know, they could be laughing stock at times because they were doing everything differently, which Team Sky were at the beginning. But then over time, everyone started doing what Team Sky were doing.
Yeah.
And actually, all they were doing when they came in as Team Sky were doing what they'd always done with British cycling.
Yeah.
They didn't really tilt more towards professional cycling when they came in.
Yeah.
In fact, they did the opposite. They stayed to what they'd always done with British cycling.
Yeah.
But they just kept getting better at it and better at it. And actually... the opposite happened. The professional peloton started going more towards British cycling. So it was really interesting to see how they stood by their guns and believed in the process.
Yeah.
And kind of, it was, they saw that was the gap they saw, was that there was a progression that could be made professionally in kind of an attitude and equipment, nutrition, science, training, psychology. They just came in and just transferred their Olympic program into the professional peloton.
Yeah.
And it was like, at first you were like, what are you doing? We've always done it this way. Don't do it this. Yeah. Don't do it that way. Then I was like, let's do it their way. That seems to work. But then they just had to learn to race. That's one of the things, I guess, with their process was the fact that Team Sky never nailed one day racing.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of anomalous.
Few exceptions, there was the Stannard year.
But that was individual riders, wasn't it?
Stannard, that was just a moment of brilliance.
And
there was Juan Antonio, to be
Antonio
fair.
Fletcher. Yeah. But again, they were individual kind of classics riders rather than a systematic kind of success. But again, that's because they did the math and they could realize they could control Grand Tours and stage racing, whereas one day racing, it's not something you can just control the variables.
Yeah.
It's the type of rider you have. You can't.
Well, which brings me nicely onto Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And Pog, the return of Pog.
The return of Pog!
Because he wasn't very good when he went off on his break, so he's been training to get better.
He's going to decimate it.
He's just been at altitude getting better at cycling.
Oh.
And he's had a good few weeks off as well, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Since he was brilliant.
since there's four or five stage wins at Catalunya and overall.
Yeah.
It's going to be, and he's going to come with, because it's Van der Poel, he's just going to put Van der Poel in his place, isn't
yeah.
he? Genuinely, I think he's just going to be like, come on, guys.
Yeah.
He's going to do something crazy, I think.
Yeah. if what we think is going to happen at Liège happens and Van der Poel is soundly beaten by Tadej Pogacar on much hillier terrain, obviously, very hilly terrain, Liège, hard. If that's what happens, then all right, Jasper Philipsen won Milan-San Remo. Mm. Come back to that. Park that thought. Mm-hmm. 100% Tadej Pogacar is going to win Lombardia again.
Yeah.
Like, he just will this
it's just
year.
His thing, yeah.
He'll win Liège for the third year in a row?
Fourth. Oh, Liège.
He crashed out last year, didn't he?
Remco was won it twice in a row.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it'll be Pog's third Liège, won't it?
It'll be his third,
second or third?
Yeah. Second, I think.
Second, maybe. All right. So, you'll end up at the end of this year, in all likelihood,
yeah.
with Mathieu van der Poel comfortably...
Yeah.
winning Flanders and Roubaix.
Yeah.
Pogacar possibly comfortably winning Liège and Lombardia.
Mm-hmm.
And fascinatingly, neither of them winning Milan-San Remo.
Yeah.
Which, in my mind, and I never thought I'd kind of find myself saying this, you could argue, kind of like, for next year, thinking ahead to next year, kind of elevates the fascination of Milan-San Remo to a different level. And in some ways, you know, it always gets criticised for being the least interesting of the classics. But actually, in this duel of Van der Poel and Pogacar, it precisely lands on that point of uncertainty between the two of them, which means that it's very hard for either of them to win. And actually, the most likely outcome of is that neither of them will win.
Yeah.
And that makes it so interesting when you've got these dominant riders.
Easiest monument to finish, hardest to win. Yeah.
So they think that's amazing.
It is.
That's where they meet. That's the point of intersection. Mm-hmm. The Poggio is accidentally perfect.
Yeah.
It's perfectly difficult, or not difficult enough, to join that graph up at the absolute point of intersection between the two of them.
Yeah.
And then in the last 2 years of that race, you could see that being played out in the final kilometre of the only in the final kilometre of a 300-kilometre race at the top of the Poggio with 5K to go.
Like 50 metres.
Just that moment.
Yeah.
And precisely the same point in the road, just where the road sign comes, when you enter the village of Poggio itself. Last year, that was where Van der Poel actually accelerated and distanced Pogacar. Mm. And this year, that's where Pogacar damn nearly did the same.
Yeah.
And if it just had 50 more metres, as you say, he could have won the race there. I think it's brilliant.
I love San Remo.
I absolutely love that. Because they are two more different riders you could hardly imagine. And yet, there they are.
It's a shame you have to commentate for 5.5 hours to get to that point.
There is that.
Yeah, that's the rub. God.
There is that. And before we leave cycling totally alone, because we've got another thing to discuss the other side of the break. Mm-hmm. But before we leave it totally alone, I was blown away by one statistic that popped up on the internet. Doesn't have anything to do with cycling, but I brought it back to cycling.
Mm-hmm.
A guy called Nick Harris, who looks into the finances of sport and mostly football, was looking through the company accounts posted by Chelsea for the last financial year. And I've forgotten the sum now, annoyingly, off the top of my head. But I think it was in excess of £40 million was what Chelsea paid agents.
Whoa.
Not players.
Just agents.
Just agents in 1 year.
Wow.
And by the way, Chelsea, as far as I know, they're not in a Champions League place. They're kind of mid-table in the Premier League. So they're a fairly underperforming Premier League team who paid agents an equivalent amount of money for which you could probably run the top two best funded teams in the Tour de France.
Just one.
Just for agents. And if you ever wanted a kind of...
Reality check
of where cycling is. Oh, and I say, leaving it alone, the other little interesting thing that I noted was the Paris Olympics. Apparently, they're going to be giving prize money in track and field events for the first time in the Olympic history. So I think each winner of gold... Yeah.
Huh.
That's very controversial.
Yeah.
Because it goes against the Corinthian spirit, mind you.
Yeah, yeah.
What,
it's IOC.
What's left of that anyway, you know, and it's the IOC.
Yeah.
But there is, I think there's a lot of, there's a schism at the top level of the IOC as to whether or not this is the right
but
course.
But so many national Olympic bodies have always awarded their athletes prize money for medals. Because I saw that even Seb Coe is talking about, like, in consideration BOA, of awarding money to medal winners. because a lot of...
I mean, on the face of it, it seems entirely reasonable. It
does seem entirely reasonable.
Like, it must be quite hard, unless you're Usain Bolt, to make a proper living out of athletics, because it's dead
exactly.
on its arse, isn't it?
It is dead on its arse. It does seem right. I mean, especially as it's funded, and it is... It carries a lot of political power as well,
yeah.
doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of... it's.
But yeah. I was reading, I can't remember who, which journalist, suggesting that one of the people quite senior in the IOC is quite opposed to that policy and is waiting to take over from Thomas Bach, who runs it now, is none other than Lapatien.
Oh, God, yeah.
Now he's definitely got his eyes on that job, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, fully.
Mm.
When I was at the UCI commentator seminar... Yeah, yeah.
Did he pop into that?
No, because apparently he's not. He's away a lot doing IOC work at the moment. So, yeah, he's definitely... That's the classic trajectory, isn't it? For become president of an international governing body, then the next step of joining the Olympic movement.
He's also a conseiller général in Morbihan in Brittany. He's a local politician.
There you go.
Yeah.
Classic French politician.
Yeah, great hair. I mean, not great hair, but very... No. Manicured haircut.
Very...
Always the same, his hair.
Have you ever spoken to him?
Once, I think, yes.
He's quite... He's so archetypal politician.
Yeah.
There's kind of just a void there. You just don't really feel like you're talking to anybody.
Yeah.
It's very surreal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break now. This is such a well-structured podcast.
Isn't it, Ned?
Huh?
Yeah.
We're going to take a little break now. And when we come back, we'll be talking art.
Art.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, David. So we set ourselves a little challenge before we started recording.
Yeah.
We gave ourselves 15 minutes.
Yeah.
To pop into the National Portrait Gallery.
Which I've never been in, incidentally. So
no,
thank you.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Well, to be fair, you've never lived in London, really.
No.
So
that's, but it's wonderful.
That does surprise me, though, a bit. And pick, I mean, hundreds of paintings there, obviously, and photographs. And pick three portraits to discuss. Show and tell.
We haven't revealed them to each other yet.
No, that's quite interesting. Although I know one of yours.
You know
one of your
of
picks.
Mine.
It's quite an obvious pick in some ways, but also brilliant.
Yeah.
And what we'll do is we'll put our pictures on the @NeverStraysFar Twitter feed, right?
Yes.
And we'll post them there so you can have a look yourselves. Who wants to start? Maybe you should start.
I should start because mine's literally the first portrait when you come into the National Portrait Gallery. And it's, I think it's about a 2 meter high headshot of King Charles, taken by Nadav Kander, who is a good friend of mine. And I would definitely say the greatest living portrait photographer in the world and portrait artist. Anybody who's anybody in the world, politician,
Trump,
celebrity,
didn't he do the cover
artist.
Of Time magazine?
Exactly.
Trump?
Yeah, he does New York Times. He's done all things on Obama. And so basically all the biggest publications, if they're going to do a portrait of a state leader or an artist or a celebrity, they want Nadav Kander to do it. And he's done this amazing portrait of King Charles. And it's just this wonderful. His portraits are kind of almost hyper-realistic. And I remember speaking to him. This was years ago, because I've known him for years. He did the portraits for my book, Racing Through the Dark and the Racer. And he does...
But wait, it's a photograph.
It's a photograph. But they almost look like paintings.
Yes.
Because the lighting he uses...
It's almost like the opposite of what you were suggesting in a way, because you were talking about hyper-realism is that genre of painting.
Well, that's what I mean. It looks so real, it doesn't look like a photograph.
When I looked at it, I had to go and check
I
was looking at.
Yeah.
Because... It does have a painterly quality about it.
He uses this really strange lighting and when he does things. And I remember saying to him, a lot of his actual art that he does, because a lot of his portraits are commercial, and a lot of his art are landscapes, And he says with his portraits, he likes to treat them as landscapes, treat the person as a landscape, and kind of find the shapes in their face and their body. And he keeps himself very removed from pop culture, so he doesn't know who he's
photographing.
Yeah, he doesn't do research on them before he goes and meets them.
It's quite interesting.
So it's really interesting. But yeah, it's a classic Nadav Kander.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, if you look at it, and it's insanely familiar, but not. There's something quite otherworldly about it.
Yes.
And
it's kind of, I seem to remember the Trump one. I think you were telling me the story, or Nadav himself, I can't remember, but about the process of kind of going over to New York, yeah. I think where the photo shoot was, or Washington, and kind of like...
It was in Trump Tower, gold penthouse, and he's sitting on a gold sort of throne chair.
Right, he's on a throne, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're kind of like, I'd say the portraits, well, I mean, they have to be, because they're like, it's almost like, kind of like Renaissance patronage, isn't it? Because he commands enormous fees, I would imagine.
Huge for doing it.
So you don't want to do something they're not going to be happy with, in a way.
Yeah.
Which is doubly impressive for this reason, because he's flattering them and yet producing works of art which stand up to scrutiny.
Mm. They're really honest.
Which is quite a trick to pull off, isn't it?
It's like you see so many people try and copy him, or do copy him, but just don't quite get it right. It's because he's created this whole look that, you'll often see kind of Nadav soft, but he's been doing that for so long, and it's just, we'll put it on there, once people see it, they'll start to notice. Go and look up the Trump portraits and the Barack Obama portraits.
Yeah.
And even today he was shooting Brian Cox and a bunch of Shakespearean actors for something.
I see.
So yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
So yes, that was my first one, Ned. What was
very
your first
good.
One?
That's very good. Mine are quite a lot sort of low key compared to that. By the way, I think he wasn't the king when he did that portrait, was he?
Prince
10 years ago.
Prince of Wales. It was relatively recent.
Or was it more recent than that?
I can tell you actually.
I think it said 2013 on it, but I might be wrong, David. I might be wrong. I don't know what order to do mine in. Let's start with a bit of... I tell you what, let's start with a bit of music that sounds like this. That music, David, was written by a composer, late 19th century composer, who died in 1912, relatively young, of tuberculosis and poverty. Because he didn't
died of poverty.
Died of poverty and stress because he was in debt. Who was called Samuel Coleridge Taylor, which is a kind of like really weird name, isn't it? Because it's the name of a very famous poet, but not because he almost bears the identical name to the great poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Mm.
But his mother, Alice, decided to call him after her favourite poets, but flipped the names around.
Just to confuse everybody.
Just to confuse everyone. So he lived his life as Samuel, let's get this right, Coleridge Taylor, and became a famous composer, which in itself is remarkable for a number of reasons. One is he was a single parent home in Holborn in London, born in the late 19th century. And even though his family tree had a lot of solid hobby musicians in their ranks, so kind of a lot of music was being played. None of them were professionals, certainly not professional composers or kind of like had ever made it, but he made it. And he became, towards the end of his life, celebrated both in London and in New York, where he had a particular audience for his work. The other remarkable thing about him, particularly, I think, is that he was a mixed race. So he was both white, British, and African heritage. His father was from West Africa, I think, but he left London before Samuel was born, and he was raised by his grandfather and his mother, Alice, and then eventually a stepfather. So Alice remarried, or married, in fact, a farrier, and they went to live in South London. So he had, like, for a kind of composer to entertain the salons and the musical theatres of 19th century Europe and America, he had a very unconventional background. But I discovered him because when I was writing my 1923 book, a lot of the composers who were writing music in 1923 drew a lot of inspiration from his work because, I think, of his racial heritage, his father's heritage. He then went on a journey of discovery as well, having been classically trained in sort of, for want of a better word, white European music. Mm-hmm. He then discovered Negro spiritual music on his own journey, especially the time he spent in the States, and kind of incorporated a lot of that into his music. And it's beautiful, beautiful stuff. And it's kind of like, I think those who know in the musical world that he's a remarkable but quite under-celebrated figure. And his photograph hangs in the National Portrait Gallery. Yeah, just open my phone, but it's a lovely photo. I got quite taken by the 19th century photographs, actually.
Yeah, there's some pretty... Oh, look at that, that's brilliant. Yeah.
It's just a little side profile of him wearing a suit, probably quite late on in his life. He died at the age of 37.
Very young.
He was pretty young, yeah. So that's some... Yeah. And the other thing about Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the poet who wrote Xanadu... Kublai Khan did Xanadu.
Yeah.
In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree and all that. He went to my college before I did, Jesus College, Cambridge. Huh. And recently, on a couple of occasions, I went back to my college, and I'm going back there in September as well to do a little kind of, funnily enough, I'm doing a talk about 1923 in the intellectual forum at my college.
Oh, no way.
I've been invited to come and talk about it.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Isn't that cool?
That's awesome.
But I've made contact with my old German professor, and he invited me to what they call in Cambridge high table. So I went for lunch relatively recently, and he invited me to where all the fellows sit at the top of this medieval hall.
Yeah.
And I dined with all the other fellows, professor of mathematics, professor of English, and all this sort of thing. And they were fascinating company as they would do. And also the librarian of Jesus College was there. And she at one point put her knife and fork down and said, "Now, you do realise there's a long-standing tradition in this college, goes back centuries, that all alumni of the college who've published donate copies of their work to the college library." And I looked at her and went, "Yeah, you don't want these." And she goes, "No, we absolutely do." So I had to send her, I've written 7 books now, I had to send her 7. I had to send her editions of every one of my books. And she sent me a message back saying, "I thought you'd like to know that the books will probably be displayed in the college library in the alumni section, which is alphabetical. And there's a fair chance, as Ned Bolting, that you'll be quite close to Samuel Taylor Coleridge."
Oh, what? Full circle.
So How I Won the Yellow Jumper will sit right next to, Xanadu.
There you go. You've made it. I love that.
That was very long-winded. What's your next pick?
I'm going to choose some backups here. I'm going with Dorothy Hodgkin.
Dorothy Hodgkin?
Yeah. She was the first British woman to win the Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
No,
yeah,
never heard of her.
In 1964, I know.
In 1964?
Yeah, she defined the structures of penicillin, vitamin B12, and insulin.
This is all important stuff.
Using X-ray crystallography, transforming their therapeutic potential.
This is important stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the portraits, it was commissioned by the gallery, painted by Maggie Hambling. And it's brilliant. She's an old lady by this point, and it's in her study.
It's great.
And she's got 4 hands because of how busy she is.
Yes.
And it's got models of molecules on her table.
And her glasses. She's got 2 pairs of glasses,
yeah,
on, maybe?
Yeah, she looks like she's got a magnifying glass in one hand.
Yeah.
Her hand's got arthritis, so they're all like wrinkled, like bent around in funny angles. And she just looks like your archetypal mad professor.
But it's just solving the mysteries of the universe,
yeah,
making people better,
yeah,
and winning a Nobel Prize.
I thought that
prize.
Was brilliant, and commissioned by the...
That's great.
It goes to show, though, that although she was the first British woman to win the Nobel Prize, the gallery had to commission the portrait.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? No one else was going to do
no
it.
No one else was going to do it.
So she lived until she was 84, died in 94. But yeah, I thought that was...
What's her name again?
Dorothy Hodgkin.
Yeah, that's great, David.
Yeah.
Never heard of her. That's
so
brilliant.
Thought,
good pick.
I thought that was a
That's
nice
a really
one.
Good pick. I remember going and presenting a darts tournament a couple of years ago in Göttingen in Germany. The University of Göttingen is one of the more prestigious German universities. Mm. And there's a cemetery near the university where they have a special section in the cemetery for 12 of their former students who've won Nobel Prizes.
What?
All in Max Planck and people like that, all in astrophysics. Quantum physics.
Yeah.
All of that. They were all men who won.
Is that the one that Oppenheimer went to?
Quite possibly.
Because that's the most reputed.
I walked out of Oppenheimer halfway through the film. I was so bored.
Really?
Yeah, I'm the only person who feels that way. I was incredibly bored by it. I thought they made the great narrative mistake of exploding the bomb in the middle of a three-hour film.
It was ruined for you.
Like, they've done the bomb. There's another hour and a half to go. and it's all going to be men in suits in committee rooms from here to the end. I just wanted to see the bomb.
Oh, God. That's brilliant. I watched it on the plane.
Did you like it?
I loved it. I thought it was great.
Fair enough. Yeah. Did you not find it a bit choppy as well? Like, just no scenes settled for more than a minute.
True. Like, I mean, it was chopping around a bit. But I watched on a plane, so I was kind of strapped in and committed.
No choice. Couldn't leave.
It was perfect for a plane. Just that.
I haven't met anyone else who feels that way about Oppenheimer. And I, even on the when I suddenly realised I can walk out of this, I'm under no obligation to stay. And I made my decision. I got up and I had to sort of make, you know,
shuffle
12 people stand
just
up.
Just going to the loo.
That amount of tutting I got. Oh my. Anyway. Right. Very good choice, David. Very good choice. Now I've gone for a sculpture.
Ooh,
Jacob Epstein.
Oh,
never know how to pronounce his name. Epstein or Epstein? Either way,
depends.
He's great. He's a genius.
Yeah,
absolute genius. And his sculpture.
Oh, brilliant! That is brilliant.
His sculpture is of Joseph Conrad.
Oh wow!
Heart of Darkness.
Oh, that is a great sculpture. It almost looks like a caricature.
I mean, Joseph Conrad.
Yeah.
I don't know how much you know about Conrad, but you know, the standout fact about Conrad is that English wasn't his mother tongue.
Oh.
He's Polish, raised Polish speaker. Huh. Studied English, learnt English, acquired English, wrote English almost better than anyone's ever written English in the history of English language writing. But when you read his works, there is something different about it, and I think it's because English wasn't his first language.
Yeah.
He approaches it with a different mentality born of being Polish, you know, and it's just incredible that he wrote not works in translation, he wrote in a second language, which is a very rare thing to do.
Huh.
Not many people have done
that,
and certainly not with the brilliance that Joseph Conrad did. Oh. Heart of Darkness is an amazing book.
It's a brilliant sculpture. Captures the madness.
Absolutely great. And also just the deep thought and stuff that's going on. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm torn on my last one. I got three that I could choose from. That's two. I can just bring
King
up
Charles
the
and I forgot
Dorothy Hodgkin.
Thank you, Dorothy Hodgkin.
I'm going to go for another woman.
Yep.
Dame Darcy Bustle.
Dame Darcy Bustle.
Yeah, the youngest ever principal dancer at the Royal Ballet. And I just thought it was a beautiful painting. It's very physical and just beautiful. And
I tell you, because the portrait gallery is good, isn't it?
Because there's very what I thought about it, there's very little that celebrates the human body in there. It's all cerebral. It's all.
Oh, you have to explain that to me a bit.
In the sense that there's no athletes. There's no kind of everything's very. There's no athletes. There's very few athletes in there.
It's restrained.
Yeah, it's restrained, and it's all people who've accomplished things.
Yeah.
In art or science. Yeah. Or.
Yeah.
It's royalty, because that's the Tudor Gallery.
Yeah. There's a video installation of David Beckham in one of the rooms.
I didn't see that.
He's just sleeping on a pillow. Very good. And I stood, I stood just, my David Beckham thought, because he's an athlete. I stood looking at another painting just next to the David Beckham installation, and two middle-aged women from behind me, over my right shoulder, who were sitting down on one of the benches, went, "Excuse me." And I went, "Sorry." She goes, "Could you just move to the side?"
Just watching Beckham sleep.
They were just sitting there watching David. And one of them turned to the other and went, "Oh, he's like a fallen angel."
Oh my God, that's brilliant. Yeah. So anyway, I saw Roger Bannister and Bobby Charlton and Frank Bruno.
Very good.
Those are the three athletes. But I just thought that one of, I thought it just captures ballet. So
very good.
Ballet is so physical and so beautiful. And I just thought that was a beautiful painting.
Have I ever told you my Roger Bannister story?
No.
Oh, it's brilliant. My mate John, who makes documentaries, he runs a film production company called Noah Media, who've made some of the best sports documentaries you've seen over recent years, including one about Jack Charlton, actually, talking about the Charltons. But years ago, he was making a documentary about the 4-minute mile. Mm. And he was obviously trying, it was when Roger Bannister was still alive, he was trying to get hold of Roger Bannister, who was proving quite difficult to track down, quite an old man already. and it'd been really frustrating. And John was on a train between A and B somewhere when his mobile phone rang with an unfamiliar number. And this is weeks of chasing Roger Bannister and not getting anywhere. He'd basically given up. And this voice on the other end, it's kind of like on the train as well because you could barely hear, said, is that McKenna? McKenna? And John went, yeah. He said, Bannister here! Bannister! And John just thought, there's someone winding me up. Yeah. So he just went, oh, fuck off, will you? And put the phone down. And the phone rang back. It's Roger Bannister. Dr. Bannister, I'm so sorry. I thought it was a friend. They got the interview.
Brilliant.
Bannister. 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 Oh, fuck off. Explicit episode. I do apologise. I think it might be the first time I've ever sworn on Never Strays Far.
You weren't swearing. It was Roger Bannister swearing.
My final pick and the final one of our art corner is a bit of stained glass. It's the only stained glass in the entire National Portrait Gallery. It was made in 1958 by an artist I'd never heard of, who I've just done a little bit of learning about, called Pauline Botti, B-O-T-Y, Botti, Botti, who was part of the British pop art scene. And she was central to it, actually. Portraits of Marilyn Monroe and stuff like this, and she was also an actor and starred in all sorts of kind of experimental films of the, but she was tragic. She died shortly after she gave birth to her only child. She died of cancer aged 28 in the late 1960s, and her work went completely forgotten for 30 years until it was kind of like, it went through a renaissance and it was rediscovered in the 1990s, and now it's quite fashionable again.
Yeah.
And she was great. And I know a little bit about stained glass simply because my wife makes beautiful stained glass, and so I know some of the technique that's gone into this, and I think it's a wonderful bit of work.
Oh, wow, yeah, it's beautiful.
It's multi-layered. It's two layers of glass that's been leaded, and there's all sorts of medieval techniques there, including painting, etching, and silver stain and stuff, and it's... that's just a beautiful bit of work. That's and beautiful. Not really what you'd associate with British pop art.
No.
Kind of quite traditional.
So one other I saw was, I saw the Shakespeare portrait.
The Shakespeare? What, the
famous? There's the only one. It's on the top floor with all the old stuff. And it was the first portrait that the National Gallery bought in 18...
Something.
I can tell you. Hang on. It was in 18... I must have read that somewhere else. But yeah, it was first. The painting was the first portrait to be acquired by the National Portrait Gallery in 1856. It is probably the only portrait of Shakespeare painted from life.
That he sat for? That's the one in all the textbooks.
Yeah. So that's upstairs. So that's quite cool.
He was really good, Shakespeare.
He was pretty good, wasn't he?
He was really good, David. I don't care if he got other people to write his stuff.
No, he was very good.
He was, which is why... He's in a category all of his own. He is world heritage.
Mm.
Everybody owns a bit of Shakespeare. Mm. He spoke to everyone. And he continues to do so. That's what I think about Shakespeare. Yeah. He's properly good.
Mm.
Well, that was good fun.
That was good. Yeah, bit of culture. Yeah. Cycling and culture.
Cycling and culture.
Never Strays Far.
It's what we do.
You both.
It's not what we do.